From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Here are some truths that are not entirely self-evident. On September 18, 2012, the people of Madison, Wisconsin will take a vow of no cannibalism. It will last 7 days. In Korea, it is common to give glass figurines, especially figurines of Vincent D'Onofrio, the Koreans' favorite actor. And when SCUBA does not stand for Self-Contained Underwater Breathing American, it stands for Southern Cuba Uncommunist Business Association. How do I know these strange facts, so unsettling to conventional wisdom, and in fact so completely bogus? I have read them all in John Hodgman's new book, the third and logically the final book in his trilogy of encyclopedic wisdom. The title is That Is All. John Hodgman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Nice to speak with you, my old nemesis.
And I should remind listeners that in addition to appearing on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart as a general expert on just about everything, you were also the person in a long-running but now long-gone series of Apple commercials in which you played the competition, the personal computer. I gather this was a life-changing experience for you.
It was indeed. People would come up to me and say, hey, personal computer, will you print out this document for me? They would say, hey, will you correct the red eye in this photograph of me? And they don't ask me to do that anymore, even though I'm really good at it.
What has it been like to fall back to earth from this pinnacle of fame you enjoyed?
Well, it's a mournful experience, quite honestly. I mean, those ads were not only a lot of fun for me to make, but also it marked a huge transformation in my life from basically magazine writer and literary humorist, you know, your basic nobody, to a very famous minor television personality. And while I understand that all things must come to an end, whether it's a television advertisement or one's life or the world itself, it doesn't make it any easier to deal with our own mortality.
Speaking of the end of the world itself, your book, That Is All, it's a very unusual book. It begins on page 607 because the trilogy, I gather, is a single work.
Yes.
It is amply footnoted, and it also includes at the top of each page a day-by-day calendar entry for the coming year that breathes a vivid, detailed life into the Mayan forecast of the end of time.
Well, as you know, this is the year 2011, and if you own a calendar, you'll know that it's just one scant year before 2012. And if you own a Mayan long count calendar, then I suspect your home is very large because those things are big and made of stone. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Mayans stopped making calendars because they thought 2012 was going to be the end of the world. And due to some visions that I had at night under the influence of my albuterol asthma inhaler, I saw some difficult things coming down the line.
I think difficult things is an understatement. Giant toads, mole men heading to the center of the earth.
Yes. You speak of the century toad that exists at the center of the earth. And, of course, the return of the ancient unspeakable ones, like H.P. Lovecraft predicted. There's the blood wave, the omega pulse, and also the collapse of the American book publishing industry.
I don't mean to make
which
light
for
of
some
that,
people
yes.
is truly the end of the world, especially those of us who only have books to write.
Yes. You in this book, just as in the first in the trilogy, the areas of my expertise, I believe you had 500 hobo names.
700. Actually. Please don't understate.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to deny you credit.
My writing of 700 ridiculous hobo nicknames.
And now you have hundreds of names of the unspeakable ones.
Who 700 return. Ancient and unspeakable gods. The ancient gods who are known for their wrath, their cosmic indifference to humanity, their tentacles, and who will soon return to the earth and make it their plaything once more.
One of the dimensions of this coming apocalypse is what you write about is the jock-nerd convergence.
Oh, this is very disturbing, isn't it?
Yes.
The fight between jock culture and nerd culture is the culture war of our time. I mean, that really, I think almost everything in life can be divided into whether it represents a jockish view of the world, which is to say authoritarian, top-down, privileging gut instinct over rumination and the hatred of anyone who uses the word rumination, and the nerd point of view, which is obsessive enthusiasm for increasingly marginal niche cultures and subcultures and a kind of joyful utopian anarchy. And yet there is so much overlap that's happening now. Now, superhero movies are apparently the only movies that are made. I read of an actual bases ball player who has named his bases ball bat after Orcrist, which is one of the elven blades in The Hobbit.
Among many other surprising facts in your book, such as how Harry Houdini escaped from a can of sardines and how
trapdoor.
The sardines were made. Yeah, trapdoor.
Spoiler alert, trapdoor.
The sardines cooperated, though, with this
with well, this as much as sardines can. They were drugged.
You also offer some useful tips on traveling around the world, which I gather that you've come by in your recent career as a deranged millionaire.
Yes. Well, now that my commercials are over, presumably because we sold all the computers, I lead a simpler life of a humble, deranged millionaire, and I've traveled all over the world to, gosh, I would say 3 continents, at least 4 provinces of Canada, most of the United States, and on cruise ships. And this is the most fascinating thing, because a cruise ship is like a fantastic floating city, and when the blood wave comes, you'll want to be on one.
When the blood wave comes, yes, rather than being on land, you're saying?
Oh, yes. I would say either when the seas rise or the blood wave comes, you will want to be on one of these gigantic cruise ships. It's one of the ways that you can survive for just a few days longer. But let me tell you, traveling on the sea, there's a lot of superstition around it. Mm-hmm. Did you know that?
I do now after reading your book, but you should share with the listeners.
Yes, I was setting myself up for that one, if you don't mind. Yes. Did you know that a woman on board is considered to be bad luck? And that's why, obviously, we let
a lot of bad luck in the world.
Yeah, we let women on board cruise ships, but they are asked to wear special rayon underwear because it is believed that vengeful Poseidon can't see through rayon. So, and dolphins swimming alongside a ship's bow are considered good luck. So when you're on a cruise ship, please don't free the dolphins that have been lashed to the front of the ship, even if it seems they're just being dragged along. It may look like they're suffering, but they're just lazy. Dolphins are incredibly lazy, as you know.
Well, now we know. And yes. You've made sailing that much more user-friendly, I guess, to use it.
Yes, and I wish to emphasize that while my book does deal with the coming global superpocalypse known as Ragnarok, it's not depressing. And indeed, there's much, much more in this book about travel and sports and wine and magic tricks and ghosts and anything that might distract a casual reader from the fact that they are mortal, which is everyone.
Well, John Hodgman, thank you very much for talking with us.
I could be wrong. I could be wrong, you know.
Let's hope.
It may be that the world will not end on December 21st, 2012.
Okay.
In which case, you can buy the paperback.
John Hodgman's book is called That Is All. Is it really the last of your encyclopedic works? Or?
It certainly is the last of my books of complete world knowledge. This is final world knowledge, at last finally complete.
Are you saying you're now going to get speculative?
I think I'm going to take a rest.
Our program is directed by Brendan Banizak, edited by Corey Turner and Allison McAdam, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Dennis Herndon. Our planning editors are Jerry Holmes and Julia Buckley. The staff includes Abby Sykes, Franklin Cater, Justine Kennan, Gabe O'Connor, Carol Klinger, Viet Le, Jennifer Longmire-Wright, and Rhonda Ray. Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin, and I'm Robert Siegel. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The television hit The Office is populated with types, albeit exaggerated ones, types you'd find in the workplace. There's been the inappropriate boss, Michael Scott, the power-hungry misfit, Dwight Schrute, and the perpetual teenager, Kelly Kapoor. She's a boy-crazy shopaholic, frivolous, and celebrity-obsessed. She also happens to be Indian-American.
I bet you get pulled over by the cops a lot just because of your race.
Well, they say it's because of texting, but maybe you're right.
I think you should consider applying for the Executive Minority Training Program.
Never thought of myself as an executive before.
I know, because you have no role models. How many Indian CEOs can you think of?
I can't think of any CEOs, any race.
You could be the Indian Bill Gates.
I could be the Indian Julia Roberts.
That's not... She's... Okay.
Mindy Kaling is the actress who brings Kelly to life on The Office, where she's also a writer and executive producer, and now add the title author of a book of essays about her life called Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me? Now, she may be a fashion-conscious Hollywood type these days, but the back cover of her book shows the child Mindy, thick glasses, ill-fitting sweater, and hair cropped into a bowl cut.
I can't believe how little effort my parents put into making me seem like an appealing little girl. I mean, I feel like you sometimes hear celebrities, they'll show photos of themselves, and they're like, I can't believe how unattractive I was. And when you really were not a very attractive kid, you really want to be like, oh, no, 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 I was the real deal. See this photo.
You do write about high school and not being very popular in high school, but the way you write about it is not to worry. The last thing anyone needs is to have high school as the high point of your life.
You know, that's one of those things where I wrote that, and even if I had heard that as a 15-year-old, that don't worry about being popular in high school, even I know that that might be just completely futile advice. I mean, I was obsessed with being popular when I was in high school, and I never achieved it. There's photos from our high school musicals and things, and I'm comically in the deep background wearing a beggar's costume. There are musicals, I didn't even know there were beggars, and I managed to play them. I played a street urchin in Evita. In City of Angels, I played a Los Angeles hobo. Like, whatever they could find, the sort of desperate-looking urchin in a musical, our drama teacher managed to find a part for me playing it.
Well, you discovered you were funny, and you discovered you had a lot of appeal when you hit college. You know, it seemed like you blossomed.
I felt incredibly special in college. I was really lucky. I mean, I went to Dartmouth College, so simply by being an Indian American woman, I was already so statistically interesting. And then the fact that I didn't want to do anything science related and I wanted to write comedy plays and act a little bit. I mean, I became deeply interesting at that college because of how rare that was.
Another rarity Mindy Kaling writes about, being average-sized in stick-skinny Hollywood. Here she reads an excerpt from the book.
Since I am not model skinny, but also not super fat and fabulously owning my hugeness, I fall into that nebulous, quote-unquote, normal American woman size that legions of fashion stylists detest. For the record, I'm a size 8, this week anyway. Many stylists hate that size because I think to them it shows that I lack the discipline to be an ascetic or the confident sassy abandon to be a total fatty hedonist. They're like, pick a lane. Just be so enormous that you need to be buried in a piano and dress accordingly.
This is the sort of reality that Kaling minds, as when Kelly Kapoor experiments with crazy fad diets.
We always think of Amazon a diet with a big groan, but I think diets are fun. I think it is an American pastime for a lot of women. I don't know. I think that Kelly thinks of dieting as a fun hobby to have.
Well, there is one moment in one of the episodes where Kelly is concocting. It's this terrible diet. It's hot sauce and grapefruit juice.
This is real. This is the
it's a real diet. Yeah,
it's a real diet, which Beyonce Knowles famously went on to lose weight for Dreamgirls. Kelly heard it, and then she tried the diet, did it for 4 days, and then fainted, I think, at work.
You're shaking. Are you all right?
Just leave me alone! I am on the third day of my cleanse diet. All I have to do is drink maple syrup, lemon juice, cayenne pepper, and water for all three meals. I just bought some bikinis online, size 2. So, I look amazing.
And you, Kelly, look like a zombie. It's like...
Yes, I do look like someone from The Walking Dead. That's pretty well observed. If you've ever done a diet like that, an incredibly restrictive diet, which I'm embarrassed to say I have tried for very short periods of time, you do become, your personality does change into that kind of Walking Dead personality.
You know, you're known, obviously, as a character on The Office, which has a cult following, practically. But you have a lot of followers on Twitter. We're talking, a couple of million?
I think right now I have 1.5 million.
Oh, only 1.5 million. Right? Well, sorry.
Whenever you brag about how many Twitter followers you have, I think Kim Kardashian has close to 10 million. And Lady Gaga has more than some huge nations. So I sort of pale in comparison to that.
Can you stop micromanaging? I know how to do this.
Okay.
But you're yelling.
What are you guys doing?
This girl was really rude to me at the mall. So I created a fake IM account from a hot guy at her high school, and now I'm trying to make her anorexic.
Tell her everyone in the homeroom thinks she's fat.
Oh, that is so good.
Mindy Kaling as Kelly Kapoor. She's also a writer and producer for The Office, and her collection of essays is called Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me? All I can say is we're hanging out here on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. And today, in honor of Halloween, you get to hear one of our reporters as you have never heard her before. That is NPR's Netta Ulaby at a haunted house in Los Angeles. Actually, it's more than just a haunted house. It is a scary play in a vacant old home, complete with the kind of special effects you could only find in the show business capital of the world.
The setting is a real decaying old white mansion with broken windows and cracked columns near downtown. Quite a few horror films have been shot right here. The mansion's rotting interior was fitted out with wires by stuntman John Braver, and he roped in friends who designed stunts for movies like Mission Impossible 4.
It was so perfect. I was like, oh, wait a minute. I have access to some of the best stunt people in the business. Why not bring them in and ask them to cut their rate?
Braver put his entire life savings into creating this interactive play called Delusion. The house is supposed to be an insane asylum in the early 1900s. All the inmates are cursed with paranormal powers. Women with wild eyes and hanging hair crawl upside down on the ceiling, wailing. And the doomed doctor who was your guide gets dragged down a hallway by an invisible hand, abandoning you halfway through the tour. But the scariest thing is when they reach out and grab you. It's so basic. But it works.
It's actively scary.
That's actor Neil Patrick Harris, about to go through the play for the second time. As a magician, he respects the show's elaborately rigged scares and stunts. But the most terrifying moment for him was low-tech. It came when he was sitting at a creepy Victorian dining room table and was then unable to stand.
The hands were holding me down and forcing me to stay seated. I couldn't get up. I think I reverted to, like, my 8-year-old self.
Delusion was developed by stuntman John Braver after he became disillusioned with traditional haunted houses.
It's a maze. Let's get the next person in. Let's just make our money and jump out and scare, simple little scares. And it's the same old thing, same old tactics.
Braver wanted deeper scares driven by psychology. He disdains guts and gore. Delusion's story is gothic and twisted, involving science gone badly awry.
What is happening? Oh my God, what is that?
That is a creeping mutant doll girl headed for our ankles.
Oh my God!
The characters are not just freaks, but unstable heroes, evil doctors, and helpful hosts who treacherously turn on the visitors. Like when my group gets herded into a tiny wood-slatted space, supposedly for our own safety.
She's locking the door.
What's happening?
Our host, I think, just got murdered. We're trapped in a cage.
Extreme reactions, says Braver, are part of the process.
We had one girl, she froze. The narrator had to literally go back in the room and grab her and pull her into the next room. That's success, I think. If you can get somebody to freeze or pee, then success.
Delusions found success in other ways. It sold more than 25,000 tickets in less than a week. And those tickets run $40 a pop. Braver would love to tailor other haunted plays to spooky old buildings all over the world. Maybe even start a haunted play franchise. For now, he hopes this is the start of a Halloween tradition.
I mean, every year I'd like to just do Haunted Play Presents Delusion. Haunted Play Presents Castration. That would be a horrible play. I would not go to that play. I recommend you stay away from that.
Remember, he's not really into gore. He likes psychological terror. So Braver would have been pleased when one visitor, 29-year-old Andrea Hadel, completely freaked out after leaving the mansion at the end and could not find her friend.
They still have Lisa! Where's Lisa? Wait, they still have her! Oh, there she is!
Lisa made it out. This time. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
This past August, the reality star Kim Kardashian married basketball player Chris Humphries. The E! Entertainment Channel broadcast the affair in a two-part special called Kim's Fairy Tale Wedding. 8 million viewers tuned in over the course of those two nights to see Kim and Chris testify about their love.
To me, our love is simple, and I don't want, like, all the distractions and everything crazy going around.
Chris and I are meant to be here. We're meant to be married and be husband and wife.
On behalf of Kim and Chris and their respective families, I want to welcome you to the celebration of marriage.
The couple is thought to have made almost $18 million selling rights to photos and videos of the wedding, the after party, even their honeymoon. Well, yesterday, the fairy tale came to an abrupt end. Kim Kardashian filed for divorce. She cites irreconcilable differences. But with all the endorsement deals, Kardashian still earned an estimated $10,000 an hour for her 72-day marriage. Not bad. So could this be a model for other celebrities looking to cash in quickly? Leslie Bruce is a senior writer for The Hollywood Reporter, and she joins us now from Los Angeles. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
First of all, should we have a moment of silence?
I think that would be appropriate, right?
Can you explain how this couple earned so many millions of dollars from their wedding?
Well, let's break it down. If you take from the weekly access alone, People Magazine reportedly paid about $1.5 million for the photos and exclusive access to the wedding. I believe it was about an 11-page feature in People Magazine. They received $100,000 for the bridal shower photos that went to OK Magazine, anywhere between $30,000 and $100,000 for the exclusive honeymoon photos that went to Us Weekly. So they're alone. They're making a pretty penny.
Up to $18 million, it's thought. How is it that that brand, the Kardashian brand, is now so valuable? The family made $65 million in 2010 alone.
I think what's really interesting about the Kardashian family is they're really the pioneers of the reality television, social media, you know, hybrid. I think that Kim Kardashian really came onto the scene right when Twitter was first, but people were first starting to figure out really what Twitter was and really how to monetize it and capitalize on it. Kim Kardashian is nothing if not a hustler and a hard worker. She really was able to take this fan base that she had, really, you know, create this relationship with them. And people, you know, hate to love, love to hate. They're really invested in her life.
Leslie, what do you mean when you say monetize Twitter? How do you do that?
Well, I mean, people can pay for spots on her Twitter page. You know, if you're, and it's also now written into her contract agreements. You know, say she's got a deal with a Las Vegas nightclub, you know, to have her birthday party at Tao Las Vegas. It's written into her contracts, you know, that she will tweet at Tao Las Vegas in order to have her followers, you know, click on their page, go to their websites, follow that Twitter feed as well. It's direct action marketing. It goes right to your consumer.
Leslie, let me ask you about the business model here, because it seems to me like it's an easy revenue stream for celebrities. You know, you sell the rights to your wedding or the pictures of your babies. Clearly, there are outlets willing to pay. So, I mean, we've seen it in the past with Brad and Pitt and Angelina Jolie. They sold photos of their twins. Do you think that this is now a paradigm? I mean, this is a model for what celebrities will start to do?
I do. I think, you know, they really created that new celebrity model for money making. There have been people before to, you know, sell rights to their baby photos, weddings, etc. I think that the Kardashians are the pioneers, though. I think that they've really created a new mold for reality stars and really almost shown them, too, as moneymakers. You know, in a time where, you know, the economy's turned on its ear, the Kardashians are finding a way to make a lot of money.
That's Hollywood Reporter senior writer Leslie Bruce on the business of being a Kardashian. Leslie, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.